So it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I'm excited about this workshop and talking about this work. So today I'm going to discuss a hierarchy of multi-party non-local effects. This is very related to what Marc Olivier was talking about yesterday. I've been working in a similar vein. And a lot of what I'm talking about today is coming from a paper on archive of a similar title by myself and Jitendra Prakash, a postdoc working with me. So by this point in the conference, we've all seen this picture a lot. This is an important experiment where you can observe Bell non-locality by two spatially separated parties measuring an entangled quantum state. And, you know, underlining that importance is the fact that this experiment won the Nobel Prize last year in physics. So we made it this far in the conference without anyone saying that, but I feel like it's an important thing that needs to be mentioned, that you know, it was Bell experiments that won the most recent physics Nobel Prize. Experiments in the 70s and 80s and 90s that those are the ones that won the experiment that really culminated in the loophole-free demonstrations in 2015, where they removed all auxiliary assumptions, or at least all auxiliary assumptions that you can remove about this experiment. And so, you know, Bell non-locality is a observable effect phenomenon that we can observe in nature. Even if you didn't know anything about quantum mechanics, you can run the experiment, you can see it. And these are the three papers of the loophole-free demonstrations. I was very lucky to be working on this. My early graduate student work, I was working on you know, how to statistically analyze these experiments without making auxiliary assumptions. And one thing that was nice about that is when you're sort of, well, how do I analyze this experiment without making any assumptions, as or few assumptions as possible, that sort of leads you naturally to these security proofs of quantum cryptography protocols. And so so running this experimental platform, we were able to generate random numbers certified by the impossibility of faster than light signaling. I think that's pretty cool. So you know, you've got these random numbers that you're generating with your experiment, and you can say, you know, no one could have predicted these numbers. No one could have written down a piece of paper with these numbers on it and put it in an envelope last week, unless that person also had the capability of sending numbers faster than the speed of light. That's about as good a predictability or unpredictability certificate you're going to get. So this two-party experiment is, you know, going strong. We've got a lot we're doing with it, but you know, I wanted to learn more about, you know, three-party experiments. You know, if we've really nailed down this two-party experiment, what can we do if we add a third party? Well, if he's just sitting there doing nothing and has nothing to do with the original two parties, then, you know, you could analyze the statistics of any experiment these three people are doing, and they would be non-classical because these people maybe can violate a Bell experiment, but it's not in a genuinely multipartite way. Because, you know, this distribution is going to factor this way. And here I've got, you know, these the probability of the outcomes of the three parties conditioned on inputs or measurement settings of the three parties, respectively. And so old definitions of genuine multipartite non-locality said that, you know, this is genuinely multipartite non-local if it does not decompose into a convex combination of probability distributions that look like this, right? So, you know, you could be running an experiment, and some of the time it could be looking like this. Part of the time, maybe Alice is alone, and then Bob and Charlie are connected by a two-way resource, you know. But if the sum total of all of that mixed together, you know, is expressible as a convex mixture of things that look like this, that would be genuine multipartite non-local, according to the old definition. Which seems pretty compelling to me, right? I mean, I like this old definition. It just looks really nice on paper. But, you know, there's a problem where if Alice and Bob are running a CHSH Bell experiment and Alice and Charlie are running a separate one, you know, maybe Alice is just two people sitting next to each other in the same room or in two different rooms, but in the same building. And that old definition would classify the overall behavior of this, where we're sort of, the A here would be all of the statistics that Alice sees shared between Charlie and Bob. This would be classified, misclassified really, as genuinely multipartite non-local according to the old definition. Let me explain misclassified. It is classified as GMNL according to the old definition, which feels like a misclassification. And so we think maybe we should revisit this definition. We don't want to be classifying this as genuinely multipartite non-local. So let's come up with a new definition. Let's say that all three parties share a bipartite non-signaling non-local resource. Each pair of parties share something like that. And then let's also allow classical information to be shared between all three parties. Like, for instance, if you're running an experiment and there's a thunderstorm going on outside, and big flashes of lightning are going on in the sky, which occasionally makes all three of your detectors fire, you don't want to accidentally classify that noise as genuinely multipartite non-local, right? So you really want to add this in, even if it's just sort of like an experimental thing to sort of rule out classical forms of noise, even if you think you can control that down. But so the new definitions say that a behavior of three parties is genuinely multipartite non-local if it cannot be obtained from an underlying network of bipartite non-classical resources, omega PQ, allowing also a tripartite classical resource, SLR. So whenever we talk about GMNL, think of this picture and say, you know, this is not GMNL. To get GMNL, we imagine that this would be a non-classical resource shared between all three parties. So variants of this definition, and this is, I'm going to sort of get into this a little bit in this talk. What sort of omega PQ resources do we want to allow in our base case of only bipartite non-local? Do we want to allow these things to be quantum? Sure, of course, they need to be non-classical. But do we want to allow them to be super quantum? Do we want them to be able to violate Bell's inequality beyond what's possible with quantum mechanics? So hyphysical, you know, super quantum resources that still obey the no signaling principle. And then what kind of measurements do we want to allow Charlie and Alice and Bob to make? Do we want to allow them just any sort of measurement that they can imagine, including an entangling measurement that would entangle Alice's portion of this with Alice's portion of this? And I'm going to argue a little bit later that we want to sort of consider the possibility of restricting their measurements to be only separate. The idea being that, you know, if you see entangled measurements, if you see the signature of that in your data, then maybe you're really seeing something beyond just the very bare basics of bipartite non-locality. So, so the interests in this are foundational because you're just thinking about what does it all mean? You know, what is non-locality? Let's understand it better. But also, this paradigm is really closely tied to the device-independent certification of effects, right? And that's because if you've got some correlation like this, some behavior, and you know that it can't be induced with a network of this form following whatever these conditions are, then if you have some constraint on behaviors that look like this and you observe a behavior in the lab that can't be induced that way, then you know that you have something that's not in this picture. You've device independently certified that you have, you know, a tripartite entangled state, and or maybe you've device independently certified that you have an entangled measurement going on. So this hierarchy, and this is the title of my paper with my co-author recently, is a hierarchy of multipartite non-local effects and device-independent effect witnesses. So let's go through these different variants. So, keep in mind that network picture where you've got, you know, the three pairs of bipartite resources. And if you allow super-quantum bipartite sources, and you allow your parties to make, you know, entangled measurements. You don't put any restriction on the kind of measurements your parties can perform. That's going to be sort of our most general notion of only bipartite non-locality, right? Yes?
Just a question here that you're allowing sort of any generalized probabilistic theory, because if I considered like box world, it would have no entangled measurements.
Right.
So you're saying if it can arise in any generalized probabilistic theory.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying. So any generalized probabilistic theory, and once we've chosen a theory, you know, if that theory has entangled measurements, we allow those as part of our bipartite network model. And correlations that can be obtained that way, we're considering only bipartite non-local. So that's this large circle. Everything in this circle is, you know, from that triangle network with the bipartite links. But if you go to all tripartite non-signaling behaviors, you know, you've got some things out here, R6. These things don't come from a network like that. And so this definition at the bottom is the most general definition you can come up with under this new paradigm of genuine multipartite non-local, that your GMNL, if you're in this set, the complement of GPT-2, and Xavier Coiteroy et Roy? Well, how would I say that? Like King? Roy? OK, thank you. And Ellie Wolf and Renou, they have this paper where they say, you know, this should be the definition of genuine multipartite non-locality. And they prove that there are correlations outside of this that exist, that are quantum, that you can get with tripartite entangled states. And in fact, they can be tested in the lab. And there have been some experimental tests sort of preliminarily investigating these R6 correlations. Now, you can say, well, let's not, you know, go into this box world land. Let's just restrict to quantum sources. And let's look at that network and say that anything that cannot be obtained by these quantum sources, quantum-only sources, but allowing for entangled measurements, anything that cannot be obtained in such a network is genuinely multipartite non-local. This is the definition given in this paper. A couple years ago. It's an interesting paper. I'd love to talk to you guys about that at some point after the talk. Kind of making the case for LOSR, as if I can remember correctly. And so, okay, any correlation outside of this set is going to witness this form of genuine multipartite non-locality, but also it's going to device independently witness the presence of a three-way entangled state. So if you're trying to run an experiment and say, oh, I've got a GHZ state or something like that, then if you can witness a correlation out of this set, then you can say, yes, we have got that. Or at least certainly we know that we've got something beyond any bipartite configuration you can have. We've got something that's tripartite entangled. So I was thinking about these things somewhat in parallel around the same time. And I also felt, you know, like the old definition of GMNL was wrong. And so I kind of felt, well, let's let this be the definition of only bipartite non-local behaviors. Let's allow the superquantum bipartite sources and disallow the entangled measurements. My argument or thinking here is that, you know, let's go back to 1850 and imagine that someone observed experimentally a violation of a Bell inequality before quantum mechanics. And
they'd be sure to write a letter to someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would probably start an epistolary correspondence about this fascinating discovery. And I would suggest that these people would sort of settle on PR boxes as kind of like, all right, there are things like this out there. You know, we don't have any quantum theory, but what we do know is that there are things that are violating, you know, Bell inequalities that are sort of non-local, non-signaling. And now this is this standalone phenomenon. We realize there's, you know, we can set up black boxes where one's here, and we can put things in and get things out, and they're going to display this non-signaling, non-local behavior. And now if they set up networks and experiments like this, they would imagine, well, I suppose I could feed the output of one as an input into another if I was in some big network. And then if all I ever saw in nature were correlations that could be obtained in networks of this form, then I would be like, you know, there's only one game in town. It's these funny two-party non-signaling boxes. But then if I started seeing other things, like the signature of an entangled measurement, that's going to be maybe a correlation that takes you out of this set, possibly. I think you would consider that a new phenomenon. Or at least that's my argument. I think it's compelling. But even if, whoa. I'll come back to that. But so this is the... Yes.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm just a little bit confused that, in box world, you use that as your example, the AR box, so you have the strongest correlations of box world. Mm-hmm. If I then allowed any entangled measurements, that would generate negative probabilities and I would get a contradiction. Mm-hmm. So are you really imagining that you're in a world where maybe you see something that's sort of stronger than quantum correlations but not at the maximum and therefore there's room for a little bit of entanglement in your measurements without generating any contradiction?
Let's just assume that... For the time being, let's assume there are correlations that exist in set R3.
Yeah.
If you're working in box world,
yeah,
and you observe a correlation in R3, I say you're going to start saying that there's something new going on.
Okay. So, and maybe that. But I'm worried about that statement that there could be this and this actually implicitly containing a contradiction. That if you say, oh, imagine that there exists some entangled measurements, and imagine that there exists some box world preparations. Those things together would generate negative probabilities, which doesn't make sense.
Well, let's say these people in 1850, you know, they come up with the concept of a violation of Bell inequality. They happen to never observe a violation of the Cyrilson bound.
Okay.
I don't think they would dream up the Cyrilson bound. I think
they.
Okay.
So yeah. They haven't seen the maximal Pierre box correlation. Uh-huh. They just sort of, that's part of that theoretical framework, but they don't.
All they know is that there's this new concept in town. It's non-signaling non-locality, violations above two. Yeah.
Okay.
Because that's all they observe. Yeah.
And they could observe entanglement swapping, for instance. And this would maybe...
This would teach them that there are entangled measurements. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But prior to having seen entanglement swapping, they might think that they live in a world where it's maximal tensor product for states, minimal tensor product for effects, because they've got nothing else going on.
Okay. So this is a definition I kind of came up with. It's clearly stimulating a little bit, so that's about all as I can hope for. Today I want to focus on this most restrictive definition, this behavior class QB2, where you have superquantum bipartite sources, no, entangled measurements, no. And this is sort of the most restrictive notion we could have of genuine multipartite non-locality, would be anything outside of here is showing things beyond, you know, what you can get with this kind of a network. We're going to call that genuinely multipartite non-locality. And if you have a correlation in here that's outside of here, you know, that's going to device independently witness the presence of an entangled measurement. Now, you could possibly spoof this with a three-way entangled state, but it's going to at least device independently witness, you know, something beyond this, right? And my argument for ruling out entangled measurements, or an argument as a genuinely multipartite, or you know, why we should disallow these from our networks, is if you witness an entangled measurement and you're trying to sort of argue that an entangled measurement happened in your experiment, you can never do that in a two-party experiment device independently. Because any two-party experiment, you can kind of just reduce it to one kind of shared quantum state that's, you know, Schmidt decomposition. And then, you know, anything that you could do with all these different subsystems and shared states with entangled measurements, if it's just two parties, you could just say, well, there's just one really big complicated state and we're measuring it without entangled measurements. So, you know, the device-independent witness of entangled measurements is an inherently three-plus party phenomenon. That's why I say maybe we shouldn't consider that a form of genuine multipartite non-locality in our experiments. if we observe correlations bearing this signature. But even if you don't agree with that, you know, come for me with the ride anyway, because we're trying to better understand the nature of entangled measurements. So let's see what we can say about this. So what was known? Well, there's a paper by Rabello et al. Called Device Independent Certification of Entangled Measurements from 2011, which demonstrated a correlation in this set that's outside of this set. It uses entanglement swapping, and so it should be in R3. It should be impossible here. And this approach requires at least three measurement settings for one party. And so, you know, let me just be clear, no one was talking about this in terms of, you know, these sets in genuine multipartite non-locality. It was just, we're going back and we're realizing that if you read this paper, they've got, you know, bipartite sources, and they get a correlation that, you know, we now see is going to be outside of QB2 and in Q2. And so this requires at least three measurement settings for one of the parties, so it's not minimal. And so in my recent paper with Jitendra Prakash, we came up with a scenario and, you know, conversations with Ellie were stimulating here and sort of thinking about these scenarios and what you can and can't do. This is a scenario in Q2 requiring an entangled measurement, so it's outside of QB2. And so let me describe this scenario a little bit. Alice and Bob always perform CHSH measurements. So that's two measurement settings for each of them. And then on setting Z equals 0, Charlie performs a Bell basis entangled measurement. He succeeds and observes C equals 0 with probability 1/4. So with a Bell basis measurement, if he does it perfectly, there's sort of four possible outcomes. Let's just choose one of those outcomes and call it success. Conditioned on that success, you know, Alice is looking at her portion of her state, Bob is looking at his portion of her state, and then after this measurement and conditioned on Charlie's success, they're now looking at portions of a state that they share that's entangled with each other, conditioned on this. And so now Alice and Bob can maxially violate the CHSH inequality. Now, if instead we change this setting to Z equals 1, now Charlie ignores Bob, and then he just looks at this, you know, qubit coming in, this photon, and he measures a direction aligned with one of Alice's directions from her CHSH measurement, leading to perfect correlations with Alice when she measures this direction. So this you can't really do without an entangled measurement. And this is in Q2, that bigger quantum set. So sort of recapping all of that, there's a behavior that looks like this in Q2 with binary input and output random variables, satisfying the condition that Charlie's swap procedure succeeds with probability positive probability. Conditioned on his success, Alice and Bob maximally violate the CHSH inequality. And when instead Charlie measures his setting 1, and Alice measures one of her CHSH measurements, Alice and Charlie equal each other with unit probability. And so that little diagram I just showed you is kind of showing you how this happens in Q2. The second part of this theorem is showing you that no behavior in QB2 can satisfy these conditions, that you know, you can't do this without that entangled measurement. So the setting for the impossibility proof is, you know, the measured state is of this form, where, you know, now these rows are kind of signifying those omegas, and they're in tensor with each other. This is how you restrict the state down from full generality. You know, if you're not familiar with the quantum formalism, rho pq is a positive trace one operator for each one of these pairs. Quantum probabilities are given by this formula. And a measurement is not entangled if the measurement operators can be written in this form. So, you know, this is a measurement operator for maybe one of the parties, like Charlie. And his measurement is not entangled if you can write it in this tensored form. And this type of measurement encompasses what I call quantum boxes and wirings and a little bit more, but it at least encompasses this, where, you know, if Charlie is, you know, measuring this state and this state, he's allowed to sort of measure this state, you know, read out his classical input, and based on that, you know, choose one of a few different measurements on this state, kind of do any kind of classical processing across those two portions, and then report a final outcome. You know, we can sort of play around with these quantum boxes and wirings this way, and that's going to be encompassed by this, which is slightly more general than the wiring paradigm, but it encompasses it. And so the proof ended up being pretty technical. It's easy to reduce the problem to pure states and ignore the shared local randomness, because you can kind of think of everything as a convex mixture of things. And if the convex mixture of things is satisfying all of these things, then at least some of those elements in the convex mixture have to also satisfy these things. So you can reduce the problem this way without too much difficulty. It's hard to reduce it from positive operator-valued measures to projection-valued measurements for Alice and Bob. So, you know, this ends up relying on self-testing. If you read a paper on self-testing, they always assume projective measurements. So, you know, when we actually sat down to say, okay, let's replace this with this, it caused problems. Standard dilation arguments apply a unitary to the state, and then that was sort of entangling our state in ways we didn't like. We had to come up with a different approach due to Perez in his book from 1993 that made everything work well. So that's a nice little technical aspect. I would recommend people think about that little result. And so then the way the proof works is if we're in QB2, we can violate CHSH with an AB link, but this means Alice only measures her portion shared with Bob. So, you know, they have this link to begin with, the one that goes across the top. So if they're violating CHSH, that means that they're measuring that top link, and they're not measuring the link shared with Charlie at the bottom. And then it was a little bit difficult to take this restriction on Alice and then sort of rewind it to, you know, what does the state look like before Charlie's measurement. So, you know, this condition is conditioned on Charlie's measurement. There ended up being some funny cases that kept popping up. So to really encompass all of that required some care to, like I say, rewind this constraint to a constraint on the joint state prior to Charlie's measurement, because then Charlie chooses a different measurement and tries to align with Alice. So that's a little bit of a feel for the theorem. This is nice because this can lead us to a device independent certification protocol that Charlie's using an entangled measurement, and it's in the simplest possible three-party, two-setting, two-outcome scenario. Anything simpler can be replicated with shared local randomness. So if you want to device independently certify an entangled measurement in a three-way network, you're never going to come up with a protocol that's simpler than this, and so this is our first kind of behavior in that category in the 3-2-2 setting. This will be important for testing hardware in a quantum network. You know, someone sells you a entanglement swapping machine and you want to test it without trusting them, you can just run a protocol like this and see, oh, it really is doing an entangled measurement, hasn't broken, without making any assumptions about the inner workings of the device. And then finally, you know, I want to return to something I talked about a little bit before. Is this correlation in NS2? And maybe I should just rewind a little bit and just remind you what I'm talking about here. So I've got a correlation that's outside here and inside here, and it employs entangled measurements, right? So it should be here because such things, entanglement swapping, is not possible in NS2. The problem is, it is possible in NS2. There exists a behavior in NS2 meeting the conditions of theorem one. It looks like this. They're kind of faking it. They're using a link across the top given by a PR box. A PR box is a non-singling distribution following this distribution. It's non-local, more non-local than quantum mechanics. If Alice does this, gets her output from the PR box, feeds it into this with a different PR box shared with Charlie, then these statistics, A, B, and C, conditioned on X, Y, and Z, are going to sort of satisfy the conditions of theorem one, and in fact, satisfy them up to the non-signaling limit. It's going to do the theorem one thing even better than quantum mechanics can. So this is surprising. And so, you know, seeing that we had that little simple model caused me to ask, you know, well, what about Rebello, this original paper from 2011, which says, you know, device independent certification of entangled measurements. This is a stronger result. It rules out not just correlations in QB2, but it also rules out unentangled measurements on tripartite states. So if you want to get the Rebello behavior, you can't just use a GHZ state and kind of spoof it. You actually have to have those two links. You have to perform an entangled measurement if you're going to get that behavior quantum mechanically. For this, Charlie has three measurement settings and four outcomes. This is because he's doing CHSH game with both Alice and Bob, two parallel CHSH games some of the time. And then other of the time, he's swapping. And conditioned on his swapping, they violate different variants of the CHSH inequality conditioned on four different outcomes of Charlie. Each outcome of Charlie corresponds to a different variant of CHSH that they maximally violate. And this also can be simulated with a network of PR boxes, which is, again, interesting because, you know, the whole point of entanglement swapping is, or not the whole point, one aspect of entanglement swapping is that, you know, it doesn't really work in box world. Well, we can kind of fake it by having these shared links between all the players. So this is a very complicated diagram. I've got a cleaner picture in the paper on the internet, but I think this, you know, gives a little bit better idea about, you know, which party is measuring which box and how they're doing their wiring, and a little bit of a viewpoint of that, you know, middle of the night madness of scrawling out something that seems to work. So that's, these were our surprising findings, and so that leaves this question open. Is R3 non-empty? Is there anything you can do in this triangle network with entangled measurements that you can't also do with PR boxes? Open question. And I would argue this really ties into a larger question. Is there a theory-independent notion of entangled measurement? You know, is there a signature in, you know, statistics of a three-party experiment that you can really point to as, like, this is, you know, what an entangled measurement is. If you're seeing this pattern, that means we know this is happening. Well, we have these theories where you can kind of just spoof it with PR boxes so far. So I think this is an important question for further consideration. And then a question that I've discussed for some time with Ellie and Mark is, you know, is R5 non-empty? As far as I know, they've been thinking about this, or at least, is there anything in here, R5 or R3, sort of feels like there should be, but to date, as far as I'm aware, these two sets may align. And, you know, so for future ideas of what we should be thinking about, let's look at scenarios where we think PR boxes can't simulate things and see if maybe they can. Let's give a second look. It would be nice to get a more robust testable constraint for this setting, sort of, you know, what's the most testable thing. It's more of a proof of principle argument. I would like to do this. And then, you know, better experiments to witness these correlations. The current experiments use post-selection. It'd be nice to close that. It may be possible to use experiments like the current experiments if you just analyze the data directly. I don't know whether it's possible or not, but I'm not convinced that it's not. I mean, maybe, you know, a different version of the current experiments, but that's sort of taken me beyond today's talk. So these are just some things I'm thinking about. I would love to discuss some of these problems with everyone in the breakout session later this morning. And so thank you for your attention. Thank you to the organizers. It's great to be here. Yeah. think that was exactly 25 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Questions?
Great. So you motivated the whole thing by kind of notions for genuine non-locality, you know?
Yeah.
But then, so I'm wondering, can you elaborate why you make the difference at entangled versus separable measurements and not, for example, entangled versus LOCC? Because somehow this would also be natural for such a notion if you think in this PR picture.
So can I elaborate why I... So there's LOCC measurements. A slightly larger thing would be things that look like this, and a larger thing would be entangled measurements. And you're sort of asking, why do I not think a little bit more about that gap between LOCC measurements and measurements like this?
So I don't know, just from your motivation, I thought you were gonna go for LOCC versus mm-hmm. the rest, and then you took this, so just kind of...
It's a technical reason, honestly. So I care about this more than I care about this. But this is a nice structural thing that I can work with in my proofs. So it gave me what I wanted and a little bit more. But yes, to me, I think that if there is some gap between LOCC measurements and measurements like this, I think that the people who could witness that gap in 1850 may well consider that to also be like some funny, weird new thing. Yes.
Good question. During your talk, you mentioned at one point that you could not witness that there are entangled measurements in a bipartite scenario. And I got to think about that. But where I landed was, I wonder from a causal inference perspective, what the number of parties corresponds to. Right, so in the quantum context, you know, we're very familiar with, oh, there's two parties or there's three parties. But if I just say, no, look, I've got settings, outcomes, I've got common causes, I've got a DAG, what remains of the notion of parties? Like, can you come up with a definition of, oh, this is a bipartite scenario, this is a tripartite scenario, that where that kind of supervenes on causal notions? Like, oh, it's a DAG that has, you know, certain nodes that have only two outgoing arrows. Like, I'm just wondering, have you given any thoughts to sort of like how we think of the partiteness in a causal native language?
Well, I'll talk first about how I think about tripartiteness in the physical world, which is literally three people space-like separated, right? And so that is a very strong notion to me. And so if I had to translate that into a DAG or something, I guess I would rule out certain types of arrows. I don't know. You know, so you can't have causal inference going from Bob or, you know. Okay, I'm not an expert in what causal influence means, but, you know, you can't send a message from Alice to Charlie. There's got to be some way to encapsulate that is the absence of an arrow, or maybe there's an arrow there, but it's a red arrow instead of a black arrow. I don't know. But for me, it really comes down to, you know, space-like separation, which gives us these non-signaling correlate restrictions. And then I think you'd want to somehow distinguish between classical influences traveling from one party to another versus quantum ones.
You know, k-people, it's like k-ancestral sets, basically. That's kind of what you're saying. Like, mm-hmm. you don't want directed arrows. That's how you think about lack of signaling, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you could have bidirected arrows because you have these weird correlations. Right?
Yeah, so I mean, what's wrong with...
Three-way common causes as well.
So I mean, what's wrong with this picture then?
Well, I mean, let me sort of tell you the kind of answer that I think should be in the offering, which is like, if you're saying, all right, we're not going to... If there's an influence between two variables, we're going to say that's in the same lab.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're not going to be talking about cases where there's communication channels. When we say a multipartite setting, we mean multipartite where sort of all the resources are some sort of shared correlations.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the DAG perspective, it'd be something like, you know, in a relativistic language, you're sort of looking for, you know, how many things are just incomparable or not cause-effect related, have no, you know, ancestrality relation.
Mm-hmm.
So here, there's three variables that I can find that... you know, have no ancestrality relation among them. And so that's why it's three-partite. And in a Bell scenario, you can only find two such variables, and that's why it's bipartite. And I suppose if you came up with very complicated graphs, you might find that at certain slices, there's three parties, and at other slices, there's four parties. That's the kind of thing I'm imagining. That it, mm-hmm. So is there a sort of a word for how many incomparable things you can find?
So there is a related concept we discussed at the glossary thing the other day, which was interference problems. Interference is like, I have two people, and I'm worried about whether one person's treatment affects another person's outcome. And so, like, usually when you write potential outcomes, you rule that out. So in other words, if I have coffee this morning, it does not affect your headache, that kind of thing. So that seems maybe similar and worth exploring.
I think that's different, because there, if I understand correctly, it's sort of about different units in the sample and the interference between them.
Yeah, but that's different people, right? So you and I are...
Right, but I think the parties in the quantum context are not about units at all. They're the parties are more about sets of variables in the DAG being causally related to one another.
Well, I mean, that's how it ends up getting cashed out in interference problems, too. I mean, maybe this is a good offline discussion for Kyle.
Sure.
But, yeah.
Did you have a question?
Second.
Okay.
Is there any question on Zoom? Let's just go to... No? All right. Let's thank Peter again.